Blog Talk Radio.
The State of the Union and the State of Women's Choice. Those are just two of the topics we'll be talking about today on Momocrats Mama Chat. I'm Donna Schwartz-Mills, and I've got Cinematic with me, and pretty soon we'll be welcoming our very special guest, Gloria Felt. And because of that, we're going to have the chat room open, which is on blogtalkradio.com/momocrats. Sin, did you watch the speech last night?
I did, and I managed to get on the Cover It Live, live blogging and tweeting and chatting and all of that for the meat of the State of the Union speech. And I have to say, you know, I agreed with everyone in the chat room who said that it was physically painful to not see the gavel in Nancy Pelosi's hands. You know, that was a striking difference for me on the opening of the, 112th Congress with this big ceremonial speech.
Well, I was in the car, as usual, and listening on the radio, but my daughter said, "Mom, who is that guy crying behind the president? And why is he so pink?" So I thought that was really funny.
What did you answer?
Gloria.
Hi, this is Gloria. I just joined.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Gloria.
Oh, welcome.
What did you tell your daughter? I want to know that.
Well, I said, it's because I was in the car. You know, I was driving home. I was in traffic. I said, that sounds like it could be John Boehner, you know, crying. You know, sure enough, I got home for the tail end of the speech, and there he was. So I think he was crying again when I think it was, you know, at the end when the president was talking about how wonderful it was in this country for people with their backgrounds to make it as far as they have. And you can see the tears starting to come.
Yeah. Well, before we fully dive in, let me just introduce Gloria a little bit for the folks who may be listening who aren't completely familiar with her background. She's an activist, keynote speaker, author, and commentator. And part of the reason we're talking to her today is that she's just released a book called No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, and we'll definitely be talking about that, as the hour unwinds. So she talks about how women are sort of stuck at about 18% of top leadership roles, and I'm guessing this is not only in Congress but also in corporate America, and we'll talk about this later too. And through inspirational stories and practical tools, she shows how women can redefine power, lead themselves with intention, and reach parity from the boardroom to the bedroom for good, for their own good and also society's good. So she's written a couple other books. One is called Send Yourself Roses, and that's written with Kathleen Turner. I'm guessing that's the amazing actress. The War on Choice, and Behind Every Choice is a Story. And another very notable thing about Gloria Felt is that she was past president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Maybe another notable thing that she includes in her bio is that she was a teen mom in West Texas. So she's had quite an incredible life journey and has all kinds of wisdom to share, and we're just so excited to talk with you today. I'm really, really excited to hear about your book. And if you don't mind, we talk a little more about the State of the Union. I'm curious about what you thought as you were listening.
Well, by the way, I'm really excited to be here. I love what you do, and really am very honored that you invited me to come and be able to have this opportunity to chat with you this afternoon. So, yes, the State of the Union. I really wanted to think that it was absolutely wonderful, over the top, and in many respects, I think it had some excellent rhetorical points. I thought it was reasonably well delivered. I was thinking this morning, as I was pedaling away on the exercise bike, which is often when I have my most erudite thoughts, I was comparing the president's speech to the film, the movie The King's Speech, which I saw recently.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about the comparison of the king who understood the importance of a leader's speech to setting the moral tone and the direction for a nation,
mm-hmm.
and the and the president, whose speech flows quite eloquently and elegantly, but he tends to use his gifts to lead from behind, where he thinks the nation is already going. So I think it was great that he focused on the economy. I loved hearing words like innovation. I think some of the pundits made fun of that, but honestly, that's how we will grow the economy. It won't really have to do with more taxes, less taxes, more this, more that. It's always innovation that grows the economy and creates new jobs. So I was delighted to hear his emphasis on innovation and education. I feel like that's our great strength. Mm-hmm. But I also think that he needs to be more in front of the parade, not just looking at the polls and responding to them. I feel like he thinks he's leading from the center, but he's really, I'd like to see him get out front more. And I didn't hear the word gun safety at all, or I was hoping he would say something about that. Mm-hmm. Didn't hear the word women at all. Was hoping he might say something about paycheck fairness. So, you know, there were some gaps that I think need to be filled in. And overall, I think it was certainly a credible speech, and I think it's going to serve him fairly well for the short term. He's going to have to do some more things for the long term.
Yeah, I wonder if in some ways it wasn't a little bit of a defensive speech in that, you know, look, we really worked our butts off. Nancy Pelosi just, you know, did amazing things in the House in terms of passing more than 490 pieces of legislation, I believe I read somewhere, you know, much of which got bogged down in the Senate and didn't go anywhere, unfortunately. But regardless, I mean, it was just an enormous amount of work that they did in the first 2 years, you know, passing all kinds of landmark legislation, and they really seized, you know, the majorities that they had and ran with it. And so now I felt in some ways it was a little bit of a defensive speech in that, okay, we've taken this, you know, we've taken this hill, now we're going to defend it.
Well, it was kind of amusing.
Yeah,
it was kind of, when he talked about winning the future, which was one of his major themes, I was thinking, well, winning the future, did we lose it or what? I mean, what? I thought we were doing pretty well.
In a way, you know, the last election set us back. And, you know, I was just personally relieved that, you know, with everybody sitting together, you didn't have any you lie moments. You know,
yeah.
It was so contentious last year,
mm-hmm.
and so distasteful. You know, this was dignified. It was calm. And I feel like I need to trust the president because, you know, as upset as I was with him for making the deal on the tax cuts in the lame duck session, he mentioned it again that the upper, you know, 2% needs to have those taxes, you know, raised.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the things that got accomplished after that. And I just feel like I don't want to be second-guessing him. He's smarter than me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's not quite as good at triangulating, however, as Bill Clinton was. And so given given the difficulties that Obama is going to have with the current Congress, it's going to be quite a challenge for him. And I hope that he will find greater strength than he has shown. I just, you know, he thinks he's leading from the center, but he keeps preemptively trying to find middle ground with people who don't keep their promises. We saw that on health reform with the deals that he made preemptively with the health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, and with, you know, he really pretty much browbeat the women's groups into accepting the CAPS amendment that was supposed to keep coverage of abortion static, no changes, no better, no worse. But instead, I think anybody who's ever done any real politics up front would know when you start from a middle place, a compromise, you have no place to go but where you don't want to go.
That's right.
And so I just hope that he learns that, you know, the one thing that if you remember when John Ashcroft was Attorney General, we discovered he was quite to the right. And we discovered that the one thing we agreed on was that old adage that there's nothing in the middle of the road but a yellow stripe and a dead armadillo. And I really think that's a lesson that Obama needs to learn. I'm all for coordination, collaboration, and compromise when you can actually move something forward. But if your colleagues are trying to just simply keep you from advancing any kind of legislation, then your best strategy is not to try to compromise with them, but rather to go to flank them and to to go to the public and get the public agreeing with you on the agenda that you want to move forward.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting what you're saying about sort of trying to lead from the center, but actually being a little bit a step behind, because I think, you know, the youth vote was so important to Obama. And granted, you know, this is maybe demographically a group of voters that hasn't quite settled into their voting habits, hasn't quite kind of, you know, picked their party designation and settled into it, and also may have expectations which, you know, are kind of ran up against the cold, hard brick wall of reality in terms of, you know, what's possible in Congress. I think we all sort of felt that, you know, reality moment many times throughout the past 2 years. But I think that's what's kind of interesting, too, because I think, you know, so often the youth various youth movements are, like, way out ahead, way out, you know, breaking new ground, you know, kind of out in the front of all of us. And so that's another thing that I find a little bit puzzling that doesn't quite square to me, because, you know, he did have such youth support. He did at least campaign in a way that showed that he really sort of understood that demographic. And so I think when all of us, you know, saw the inevitable sort of pullback from a lot of those really strong positions, at least in the campaign, you know, that was sort of an uncomfortable, you know, reckoning. And then to see, you know, sort of further, as you say, trying to keep the center together, but actually from behind instead of maybe trying to get out in front of some of these things and stake out, you know, a clearer position, is a little disappointing. So we'll see what happens, because, you know, for 2012, obviously, you know, these youth voters are now 4 years older and wiser and all the rest, confronting, you know, the very difficult economy that we have, and, you know, in some cases graduating from college, not able to get a job, you know, all those kinds of things. So it'll be a very interesting picture in 2012, I think, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how he has to reposition himself, you know, accordingly.
Well, you know, so much of what happens in the next election will be up to us, to we the people. And I hope that we remember that elections don't end on election day, that actually the next election starts the next day.
Yeah.
And that we can have an influence. We need to let him know what we think and what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sure, the youth vote that was energized in 2008 is now going to be 4 years older in 2012, but there's a whole other cohort rising up behind them, and and, you know, we need to engage them, and Obama needs to engage them, and
right.
And hopefully he's thinking about all those things.
Right. So should we talk about your book? I'm really curious, you know, how it is that you embarked on the project, and, you know, it was released last fall, I believe, so now you've had a chance to go around on book tours with it, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about the process of coming to write it and then also putting it out there in the world and the kind of response that you've been getting.
I would be delighted to. I basically, no excuses, took about 18 months to write, but a lifetime on the front lines to learn what I put into it. So it's the culmination of many things and many sources. The immediate inspiration for it, though, was somewhat related to the conversation we were just having about politics. And it is that in 2008, I wrote an article for Elle magazine that was supposed to be about the various organizations that are helping women run for office. You know, there are so many of them now. There are the nonpartisan ones, or bipartisan or nonpartisan. Some say I'm bipartisan, some say we're nonpartisan, but like the Women's Campaign Forum, the White House Project, the Women's Political Caucus, and so forth. And then, of course, there are partisan groups like the Wish List and the Emily's List, and, you know, on either side of the aisle. But they have spent millions of dollars, and they have certainly engaged many, many women in considering the idea of running for office. But you know, in the last 3 decades, they have scarcely moved the dial forward. Women are still standing at 17% of Congress, a little bit less, actually. There were some one or two losses during this last election. And in state legislatures, it's a little bit better, maybe 23-25% women in the state legislatures. And so this despite all the work that's been done. So I began to look into why that was. And I love Jennifer Lawless's book called It Takes a Candidate. She has actually an update released called It Still Takes a Candidate, in which she verifies much of the data that I'm talking about in terms of women still not coming up to the plate and deciding to run for office. But she postulated that it was sort of women didn't have as much ambition, as much political ambition in particular, as men do. Mm-hmm. The more I looked at it, the more I thought, no, it's not that women don't have ambition, because if a woman feels like there's an injustice and she can do something about it to fix it, she'll jump in there and she'll do it. I mean, Patty Murray in Washington, when a state legislator who she was trying to persuade to restore funding for her child's kindergarten told her she was just a mom in tennis shoes, and what did she know? She became angry enough to run for office and, in fact, defeat that legislator and then ultimately become a U.S. senator.
I love when you tell that story, because them's are fighting words.
Them's are fighting words, just a mom in tennis shoes. I mean, really. But that's the proper reaction. And when women feel like, you know, they need to do something to help their families, their communities, their country, they'll jump to it and do it. But I think that women are still not socialized, girls are still not socialized as much to have that kind of intention. You know, in other words, to seek those positions for the sake of seeking those positions and the power you can have to actually make a difference, absent some specific injustice that we see. And so that's when I decided I wanted to write No Excuses. And then I realized the dynamics were exactly the same, whether it's the workplace, politics, or even personal relationships. And you're right, you mentioned that the percentages of women in the upper echelon positions in the workplace are pretty similar to that in politics. It's under 20% across the board. And when you get to the very highest level, women are under 5% of CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies. They are under 5% of the CEOs and even the top leadership of media companies, the major media companies. Now, think about the impact that has on what gets to be a story and how that story gets to be framed and covered and what the media narratives are. And think about the impact that has on girls growing up.
Right. And it's a sort of negatively reinforcing dynamic, as we know from Sam Bennett, who is, isn't she behind WCF Women's Campaign Forum?
Yes, she is, yes.
Yeah, because she ran for office and experienced the most disgusting, you know, outright in-your-face sexism with regard to her candidacy and just completely inappropriate questions asked to her. And, of course, you know, this is the very kind of thing that is a sort of chilling effect on women who think, who finally get to the point of like, well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a try. And then, you know, this is what they're met with. And so, you know, confronting a very male-dominated media atmosphere from political punditry onward, you know, and then this is what you're met with. So it's a very terrible self-reinforcing cycle, I think.
It is indeed. And so what I wanted to do, because I've been a practical activist all my life, and I really hate those books that tell women, oh, this is what's wrong with you. You know, this is why you don't do things. This is why you can't. This is why you make all these mistakes and bad choices and so forth. So what I wanted to do is to write a book that had very practical tools and techniques that I learned on the front lines of working in social justice movements and running organizations, and also that kind of advice that I could learn from other women, because I took this opportunity to interview women all over the country and find out how they have done it, what worked for them, Also did considerable research into the history of the women's movement and the current status of women. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to put all that together, and that's why the subtitle of No Excuses is 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. And those 9 ways are very specific and practical, what I call power tools, that women can use when they come up against exactly what you were describing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I give women some very specific advice about, well, how you deal with that conflict and controversy, you know, or when they come after you in the media, what is it that you can do to actually make your voice stronger and make your voice prevail? So those are the kinds of very practical tools that I wanted to give women, and I'm pleased to say, as I've been out doing book events, that's what really resonates with women, and it seems to be resonating with women of all ages, which is quite a pleasant surprise to me.
Great. Yeah. I was just as inspired by all the seasoned politicos who are women who were luckily reelected back into Congress as I was by Crystal Ball, you know, a first-time candidate and someone very young, a young mother, someone with a very young child. You know, I was inspired by them all. Speaking of Crystal Ball, I mean, there's another person who got some really sort of unwelcome media attention in terms of wearing a silly costume or whatever. But you say that, you know, there are techniques and tools, and if you just sort of power through it, if you address it head on, number one, and if you power through it, then it should be fine. And it ended up being that way for her, don't you think?
I think it did. I did an MSNBC program with her just recently, and it was really illuminating to me to hear her talk about it. And I also saw some research that the pollster Celinda Lake did on women and political controversy. And both of them agreed that the way to deal with it is to ride into the wave of it, to use that controversy to give you the platform, deliver your message right on top of that platform.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes at you, don't back off. And in fact, they get women candidates get much more respect when they do that. So I think that was a great lesson, and I think Crystal Ball handled it exceedingly well. I suspect we will see more from her. I believe we will see her running for office again, and I'll bet she'll be successful the next time around.
Oh, I sure hope so. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, just looking on the other side of the aisle, Nikki Haley sort of had a similar issue or scandal sort of crop up as to whether or not, you know, someone had had it. She'd had an affair with someone who had previously been a staffer, or, you know, it's just a sort of a big stink that could have really derailed her. And I noticed that she really just sort of rode into the wave of it also, and it ended up not harming her at all. And I think she's, you know, happily ensconced as a governor, isn't it, in South Carolina?
That is true. All of that is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. I mean, as to whether or not Nikki Haley is in favor of programs that I would consider feminist in that they support women and children and families and so forth, that's kind of another question. But just in terms of, like, campaign tactics and strategy, she really just had this sort of fortitude, which I grudgingly had to admire.
Absolutely. And I'm a great believer in learning from both your friends and your adversaries when it comes to politics. We can learn a lot. I mean, we can learn a lot from Sarah Palin. It was interesting, actually. Crystal Ball said that one of the things that inspired her to go ahead and run was seeing Sarah Palin out there running for office as a mom of small children.
Uh-huh.
And so, we can learn from everybody, and we mm-hmm. should learn from everybody. That doesn't mean we have to compromise our principles at all.
Right. And I know just recently you had a fascinating discussion with Rebecca Traister, who I believe just recently came out with that op-ed piece about cowgirls, only cowgirls
yeah.
get elected. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? That was so interesting.
That was a great article.
It was very interesting. Well, first of all, Rebecca is, I think, one of the most brilliant young feminist writers out there. I just think she is absolutely fantastic, and had the pleasure and honor of having her on a panel last Sunday night at the 92nd Street Y in New York. And part of the fun of it was that I wore my cowboy boots in her honor, and I told her that I didn't actually agree with her conclusion.
Uh-huh.
And It's interesting because she said two things, basically. One, she said one of the things that she postulated was that the cowgirl is the one uniquely American political icon that that is accepted by American in American politics for women, that the cowgirl can win where others cannot.
I was just going to say, I remember briefly Hillary Clinton trying to dip a toe in those Annie Oakley waters and, candidate Obama sort of calling her out on that. So it can work, but in that case, the cowgirl boot didn't quite seem to fit.
Well, what Rebecca didn't know was that I grew up in Texas, and my father actually made Western wear. So I actually grew up wearing I was a cowgirl. I rode horses and did all kinds of cowgirl things. Mm-hmm. So we had a good fun with it. But one of the things that she surmised was that the reason more women have been elected in the Western states than in the Eastern states is that cowgirl mentality. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the reason that more women have been elected in the Western states is that these are newer cultures, and it's another one of my power tools is the idea that chaos is opportunity. And when there is a new culture and a new society being formed, the boundaries are much more fluid. And so, you know, people are willing to accept women taking on roles that they wouldn't have accepted in a more ossified kind of culture that had been really around for many, 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 many years. And the other thing is, I think in the Western states, that women had to be physically strong enough to do things independently that they didn't have to do in the Eastern states. Mm-hmm. So I did have a little bit of disagreement with Rebecca's thesis, but I have to tell you, she is the most brilliant writer, and I loved the article. I had great fun with it and great fun talking with her about it.
And I think
for those who are listening in, I just want to mention that the link to the article in question is on the Momocrats Facebook page. And we have four people in the chat room, but nobody's asked any questions yet.
Well.
So anybody who has questions for Gloria, please feel free to come join us in the chat room. And we're watching that and looking for your questions for Gloria. Okay.
Announcing that. With regard to the sort of Annie Oakley cowgirl idea, I think it's really very much like a sort of pioneer woman vibe that is kind of explicitly tied to Little House on the Prairie and Laura Ingalls Wilder. I cannot remember the name of the author right now, but I remember reading this fabulous post talking about Laura Ingalls Wilder and her rock-ribbed conservative politics. And, you know, I think it's sort of a rite of passage that if you grow up a girl in America, you know, you definitely know who Barbie is, and you definitely want a pony at some point. And then you probably also have read or have some acquaintance with the Little House on the Prairie series. And I think that, you know, Sarah Palin really kind of explicitly ties herself to, you know, that sort of pioneering, outdoorsy, you know, groundbreaking kind of woman. She definitely fashions herself in that mold, and I think, yeah, that definitely makes sense to me that it, you know, resonates with a lot of people. And you know, when you're a little girl reading Little House on the Prairie and Pa and Ma Ingalls and, you know, Mary and so on the rest, I mean, you're not thinking in partisan terms. You're not thinking about, you know, okay, manifest destiny. What were the ideological implications of that? You're just thinking, like, what a fabulous story. This is a little bit of history I'm getting. And, you know, the politics of it are kind of a little disguised. And I think in the same way, you know, Sarah Palin sort of tapping into the pioneer woman vibe is, you know, really kind of tapping into something very powerful, but at its you know, in a true core ways, there's something very conservative about it.
That is all true. And I, you know, once many years ago, I conceptualized a novel that I never got around to writing, but it was a lot of fun to just talk about possibly writing. And the it was based around the first woman president. Now, this was 25 years ago that I was thinking about this and conjuring it up. And this the first woman president would turn out to be a right-wing Republican who opposed women's reproductive rights, who loved sending young men to war, who, you know, was just like had all of those kind of Wild West kinds of ways about her. And it was almost ironic, if not amusing, to see so many of these characteristics actually turning out to be quite possibly the first woman vice president at any case. And so in a way, it's the Nixon could go to China kind of thing. You know, it's the not the usual suspect often is the one who gets to be the first.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony, of course, is that it has been progressive women who started most of these organizations that help women run for office that actually came up with the idea that there should be more women, more parity for women in political office. And even for example, with the Women's Political Caucus, I was talking to one of the founders of the Women's Political Caucus recently, and she said, you know, we had both Republicans and Democrats, and we were explicitly bipartisan, and everybody got along just fine. But they did have certain ideological requirements. The woman had to be pro-choice and support the ERA at a minimum. And I think her point was that it was progressive women, whether Republicans, Democrats, or independents, who actually helped get these organizations started with the idea that we should be fighting to get more women into office. So the irony is that now that the doors have been open, we have many very right-wing conservative women who are rushing through those doors. And I think that puts progressive women, Democrats, and progressive independents in a very interesting situation of having to come out of the closet and say, yeah, but it also matters what the woman's agenda is. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a really transformational moment right now.
Yeah, I want to press you a little bit on that bipartisanship, because I know that that has been sort of the party line, so to speak, of these organizations that do such wonderful work trying to get more women into elected office. And I think up to a certain point, I felt like, absolutely, yes, you know, that some woman in there has to be better than no woman. But then I look at Michelle Bachmann, I look at what it was that Christine O'Donnell purported to believe policy-wise. It was a little sketchy, but what I could discern of her policy statements, you know, they really didn't seem, they're definitely not pro-choice, all kinds of ways in which, you know, programs that are important to low-income women, working women, you know, all these kinds of things, women with children, that they would be defunded or cut back or pared away or somehow it would set us back several years in terms of the gains that we've tried to make. And so I really have a hard time now supporting, you know, the idea of any woman in office is better than, you know, yet another man. I wrestle with this. I'm someone who's kind of, you know, said at many occasions, it's like, well, you know, I feel like any gain that's made by right-wing women is sort of ancillary to the main project of feminism, which I feel is, you know, social justice and women's rights and reproductive justice, so on and so forth. So I would love, you know, more thoughts from you on this, because I just wrestle with it so much.
Well, I just think it's a conversation that we need to have, and we should have it now before the next election season comes about, because we don't want to get tripped up on it in the media or any place else. I think we need to get clear in our own minds. I just decided, well, I'm quite ready and prepared to say that it is the agenda that the woman puts forward. I want women to reach parity, and I want that to mean that women who actually care about advancing women reach parity. Mm-hmm. So that's my take on it. I'd love to hear what other people have to say, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, strongly supporting pro-choice men, which is always very important.
Yeah,
to have allies who are stalwart and, you know, will absolutely stand by you and on those key votes.
No, that's one of the reasons why it was so unusual this year. We had a woman nominated for governor, and very few progressive women were supporting Meg Whitman. that she was an anti-choice candidate. Same with Carly Fiorina, who was running for Senate in our state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a very unusual election that you had two women running against each other for Senate.
That's absolutely right. Yes, and you know, those are the kinds of things. Those simply mean that we're progressing. That means that we're actually having some success. So we should celebrate that. But I don't think it should make us. We shouldn't throw us off our game. It shouldn't make any of us feel like we need to violate our own principles. And that's just, you know, those things are now going to happen with increasing regularity. It's a more complex situation. It's just not as clear cut as it used to be.
Right.
Right.
And there were, I think, two women who were vying for senator, was it, in Oklahoma? And one was definitely anti-choice, and then the Democratic woman who ultimately lost, I believe, was sort of tepidly pro-choice, as I recall. But, yeah, I think we're going to definitely see, you know, more gradations of gray in terms of, you know, various stances. I mean, obviously, you know, there's Senator Barbara Boxer, who is just right out there and, you know, has always been sort of a leader in terms of feminism. And then there's Senator Dianne Feinstein, who, you know, has her own kind of way of approaching some of these issues, you know, a little more conservative than perhaps Senator Boxer on some, and, you know, out there more on others. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that we can make these distinctions and understand them and understand, you know, be able to perceive these different shades of gray is, I think, progress, absolutely, as you were saying.
I think progressives are comfortable with shades of gray. I think the other side wants to see everything black and white. You know?
That's both our strength and our weakness, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. It can cut against us, yeah. Well, Gloria, you know, very recently was the 38th anniversary, is that right? 38th anniversary of Roe v. Wade on January 22nd. And so there's been a whole campaign with silver ribbons and, you know, remember Roe v. Wade, you know, remember how much of a struggle it was to make, you know, abortion safe and legal, and, you know, how much more of a fight we have ahead of us. And so given, you know, your past perch at Planned Parenthood and obviously, you know, your very strong pro-choice commitments now, you know, maybe you can give us a sense of, like, just what we're at risk of losing in, you know, now that we have this 112th Congress and this GOP House majority.
I have a very tough message to deliver on that. I actually feel that Roe versus Wade will probably not ever be overturned in its entirety, because I believe that the concept of privacy is so ingrained in American society that I just wouldn't expect any Supreme Court to overturn Roe in its entirety. But I do believe that with the court cases that have chipped away at women's reproductive rights within Roe, that the ruling itself is a very thin shell right now. And that so far the court has not found any burden that it considers undue to women, short of completely outlawing abortion. So my feeling is that we need to be engaged in literally creating a new concept, a new legal construct, and a new cultural, moral, ethical construct around the notion of women's human rights. Women's human rights to our bodily integrity. And in fact, the Freedom of Choice Act, which has been introduced many times in Congress, and in its current iteration, is a civil rights act, is the way we need to approach it. It used to be, when in the first iteration of the Freedom of Choice Act, it basically codified Roe. But that was redone a few years back while I was still president of Planned Parenthood, because we felt it was very important that reproductive rights had been so eroded that we really needed to start to build a very different legal basis for it. And that legal basis needs to be that it's a civil right. It would be more of a 14th Amendment equal protection kind of thing than, you know, than a First Amendment privacy, freedom of speech kind of thing. It needs to have a stronger moral basis. And I think that, you know, choice is never going to trump life, let's face it. It's just not. Mm-hmm. And so we need to have something that's stronger than choice, stronger than privacy, that really gets to the integrity of the woman as a human being, mm-hmm. and our valuing of the woman as an equal citizen who has the moral and legal and ethical capabilities to make her own decisions about childbearing. And so I really think that we should start introducing the Freedom of Choice Act as a civil rights act, state by state by state. Not that I think it's going to pass everywhere, mm-hmm. but I think you have to put it out there so that then you can start the conversation.
Right.
And it may take decades, but I think we have to build an entirely new movement. I know that's a radical thing to say. If anybody wants to see more about how I feel about that or how I actually articulate it, I wrote a piece for the Democracy Journal a couple of years ago called, and I have it on my website also. My website is GloriaFelt.com, and the name of the article is Beyond Roe and Toward Human Rights for Women.
Mm-hmm.
And I really tried to lay that out as we just, you know, it's not that it's privacy is important, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient, and it's never going to be, and we're going to keep fighting these defensive battles over and over and over again. We're going to keep getting pushed back until we actually assert that women are fundamentally human beings and need to be treated as such.
I know, a startling revelation,
isn't it though? How radical is that?
Well, and we know that the anti-choice forces are really, you know, chomping at the bit in order to get their agenda going. And I've been tracking a little bit H.R. 3, which, you know, they are starting to mobilize on Capitol Hill. I know that it's been explained to me as it codifies the Hyde Amendment. Can you unpack that a little bit for folks who aren't completely up to speed on what that might mean?
Well, codifying the Hyde Amendment means that no government funds can be used to, in any way, shape, or form, and I'll unpack that piece of it in just a moment.
Okay.
That no government funds can be used to provide abortion services. Now, the sticky wicket that we're into with health reform is that the current attempt is to apply that principle to any insurance plan in the insurance pool that people might call upon to actually even, you know, to pay for with their own money.
It smells like Stupak pits all over again.
Of course it is. First of all, the whole idea of the Hyde Amendment is wrong. It's just wrong. I mean, abortion services are a part of basic women's health care and should be treated as such and should be, as most insurance plans do, cover it. And it's a part of basic women's health care.
Mm-hmm.
And those who oppose it also try to then designate certain kinds of birth control as abortifacients. So, mm-hmm. and that includes birth control pills,
right,
and emergency contraception. And so it's just a huge sticky wicket. It's a very big minefield. And frankly, I think, you know, we shouldn't just be opposing measures of that nature. We should be revealing the basic injustice of the Hyde Amendment to begin with. I mean, that has made poor women hostages.
Mm-hmm.
To a healthcare system that doesn't treat them
mm-hmm.
as equals.
Mm-hmm.
So, and forces them into very difficult choices that they have to make. And so, again, I just feel like we need a whole new approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that in some ways, it sort of puzzled me a little bit why Antonin Scalia, one of the Supreme Court justices, kept making a point to say that he did not think that women's rights were enunciated in the Constitution in any way, et cetera, so on and so forth. And I kept puzzling, like, why does he keep bothering to say this? I mean, it seems so out there. And I think that it, in some ways, maybe it is him trying to get out in front of this whole discussion of women's bodily rights as human rights, in some way. Try to stave that off. Because otherwise it just doesn't make any sense, because it just really seems to come out of left field.
Yes. Now, I mean, of course, African Americans also didn't have rights within the Constitution, or at best were considered, what, three-fifths of a person?
Right.
So, I mean, surely he is not going to defend that, and he needs to be confronted on that. I mean, that needs to be pointed out. We really are talking about just basic fundamental principles of American equality, liberty, and justice. It's nothing more than that. It's not even more complicated than that.
Right, right. I completely agree. I think there's a big, long, lifetime battle ahead of us all.
Yes, and I'm hoping that the momocrats are ready to take it on.
Yeah, well, you know, we are moms for choice. You know, we are moms by choice and we are moms before choice.
That's right. That's right.
So,
oh, dear.
We need to be powerful spokeswomen, you know, on that front, definitely. Yeah. So let's see. I guess I wanted to also ask you, in terms of the book, you know, about, let's see, where was I? We talked about cowgirls. We talked about Roe. I guess I was actually wondering, too, because I think that in terms of there being sort of a chilling effect, I mean, I think really what's so wonderful about your book, it seems to me, is that you're taking away all the reasons why women tell themselves, well, I can't do that, or I wouldn't think of doing that, right? And taking away those reasons and saying, well, yeah, sure, of course you can. And I think that in some ways, the recent, I'm thinking of two things, obviously the assassination attempt on Gabrielle Giffords, you know, has definitely put a chill in the air. I think even male congressional representatives are now sort of slowly awakening to the fact that, you know, by being public officials and being in the public eye and having a certain profile, that, you know, a mentally ill person or a disturbed person who has a gun of some kind could easily target anyone, right, who is in the public profile in that way.
Right.
So there's now that has kind of been introduced in our political culture. And then I think there's also kind of the disturbing issue of Glenn Beck, for example, targeting Professor Francis Fox Pibbon, and a lot of the rhetoric really just being over the top. Of course it's Glenn Beck, so, you know, half of it doesn't even make sense, and the other half isn't true. But, you know, he's really, you know, sort of targeting this one professor as sort of an enemy of the state, like this horrible, you know, communist infiltrator. I don't even know, like, what he's trying to say she is, but it's just scary, and we're just supposed to be scared by it, apparently. But I think that's kind of another way that, you know, ideologically, that, you know, he's trying to make a big enemy out of her. And I've read in The Nation and in other places that, you know, she's received some death threats, et cetera. So there's another way that as women are making gains, at the same time, there are these forces that are, you know, trying to pull us back in terms of us feeling safe, us feeling empowered, feeling enabled and, you know, powerful enough to kind of confront these sorts of forces. So I wonder if you have some comment on that.
It's not new to me. It's certainly not new to me. Certainly in my life with Planned Parenthood, I experienced the escalation. I was the head of Planned Parenthood both in Arizona and then in the national organization during the time of the greatest escalation of anti-choice activism, and at the time when Operation Rescue began their clinic blockades, at the time when we were having bomb threats, literally bombings, burnings. I personally had death threats, picketers at my home, stalkers, you name it. And I'll tell you, what I learned from that is that you never benefit by backing off. You have to learn to be, you can learn to be very prudent and careful and to take measures. And I actually, I serve on the board of Emerge America, which helps women, Democratic women, run for office. And I have offered to, you know, to help them and have enlisted some security professionals to just try to, you know, to do a seminar at some point to to give them just the basic things that people need to do to protect themselves. And when I saw what happened in Tucson, my immediate thought was, oh, my goodness, they should never have set up in that space where there was nothing in the nothing behind them, and there was such easy physical access. That was just a security nightmare to begin with. So there are specific things you can learn to do to protect yourself. But the most important thing is the mindset. And I it's incredibly important not to let terrorists run your life. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly important not to let them win. It's incredibly important. The only antidote to the Glenn Becks is for our voices to be stronger and for our message to resonate more. That's the only real antidote to it. And so we have to really look at it that way. And I don't make light of any of it. I certainly don't. I have a lot of empathy for people who put themselves in harm's way. But it's true for men as well as for women. I mean, up to now, it's been, with the assassinations, the political assassinations were of male political leaders. And yes, so as women reach equality in those positions, it's not unlikely that women may become the targets too. But that, again, is what equality is about. It's we take our equal place, and together, I think men and women have to create a more just and civil society. And frankly, I think that having more women in office is one of the things that can actually help transform that political process if we are willing to assume leadership on that. The World Bank did studies of parliaments all across the world, and they concluded that those parliaments that had 30% or more women in them made better decisions and were less likely to go headlong into violent kinds of situations. So we gotta, if we want half of the positions in the world, we have to be willing to take half of the responsibility. And so we're going to have to learn. And again, I have some very specific tips, tools, and the power tools, and no excuses. For example, I tell women to embrace controversy because you can make controversy your friend. As I already mentioned, carpe the chaos. Understand that there are ways you can actually use these situations to your advantage. One of my favorite ones is wear the shirt. A friend of mine once said the fastest way to self-esteem is to stand up for what you believe. And so the metaphor of wearing the shirt to me is it expresses that. I just think that when we don't speak up for what we believe in the small things, that's when the big things get out of control, and we gotta be there.
Yeah, and I think this needs to take place on a very small scale also, because I think it's one thing to scream at the TV and try to shut Glenn Beck down, which is quite an effort requiring a lot of people. But the reason I'm thinking of this is that recently it came to light that one of the Momocrats, very politically active, high social media profile, Erin Kotecki Vest, who is our beloved Queen of Spain, had been the recipient of some really, really nasty, violent-sounding kinds of threats on Twitter, just various places around. And, it's just very disturbing seeing that so close to home. I mean, we all love Erin to death. I mean, that's a terrible way to put it, but
that term.
We love her to pieces. And and so obviously, something that was very concerning for all of us. And, she is a very outspoken, strong voice. And so we wanted to know how to support her. And I think that, one thing that has become a little more clear to me is that there seems to be sort of like a civil liberties sort of sense of like, well, when the government comes knocking, these companies like Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth, they shouldn't, be so easy to cough up personal information. And while on a sort of civil liberties front, I completely understand that, I think that when stalkers and violent people are trying to use these sort of social media to harass and threaten other people, most of the time it's women, then I think there needs to be another kind of level of responsibility in terms of cooperating with the authorities. And, I think in many cases that has not been as easy as it needs to be, because I think women online, it's online stalking as well. you know, yes. online threats. And I think that, you know, yes, we speak out on that. And I think that it, you know, for those of us who are in her circle, if we come around her and say, you know, this is unacceptable, this is not right, you know, then
absolutely,
we
and
play
be
our small
to...
role in trying to stop it. But I think there's, you know, there's also the responsibility of the social media corporations or companies.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the other small ways that we can be helpful include putting some positive comments onto other people's, other women's blogs. If they're getting these really mean, nasty, threatening posts, then it's incumbent upon those of us who see them to counter them with our own positive
right.
words for that individual woman, and to call the offending person on their behavior. And that actually, you've seen that happen, I'm sure, in group situations before, where
yeah.
there's somebody who is just raising a big ruckus, and at first people are quiet and they back off, and then after a while they've had it and they start taking that individual on, and that's what ultimately changes the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we can do it in absolutely in small ways. In my case, I really appreciate it when people write positive comments, say, for example, a positive review on Amazon, because I have my personal trolls.
Yes.
And it appears to
yeah.
me, I had two people, I was getting 5 stars on all the reviews that people were putting on Amazon, and suddenly 2 1-star reviews popped up, and they were almost exactly alike. They were clearly the party line, we hate Gloria, you know. As I said, I have my personal trolls.
Right.
And what I saw over time was, it appears to me, that those, I mean, wonderful people, I don't even know who they were, but eventually those 2 1-star reviews disappeared, because I believe the Amazon people got enough pushback that they realized that those were just trolls and they weren't legitimate reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're gone. But that's the kind of thing that can really help. And it doesn't take a whole lot of effort. It's just the small things that we do on a daily basis. You see a little injustice, you say something about it, makes a big difference.
Yeah. I think, in fact, not letting the little things slide, in fact, helps the bigger things from snowballing too much. And I feel like we've let maybe a few too many things slide here and there. And so now we've got some really big problems that are going to take a lot, you know, of effort to sort of root out and you know, get us into more a healthy track.
Right.
So, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so I don't want to kind of dwell too much on the
right.
trials
we
and tribulations.
Right, we only have 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
Well, on a positive note, on a very positive note,
yes.
I would like to, first of all, just thank everybody who has been so incredibly supportive of No Excuses, and to invite anyone who's interested in having conversations about the 9 ways to come to the blog that I created called 9 ways on my website, GloriaFelt.com. So I use that one to talk about the 9 ways and to provide a space for women to share their stories about how they have either empowered themselves or realized that they had the power to do something and could share that with others. And the other blog that I have had for quite some time that really focuses more on politics is called Heartfelt. Heartfelt, spelled like my last name, with a D, F-E-L-D-T. And so I just want to invite anyone.
And that's also your Twitter handle.
Well, you know, I actually had to start using my real name on my Twitter handle.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. I had to give up Heartfelt. It's still out there. I can't quite. I didn't close out the account because I just love it.
Uh-huh.
But I needed to actually use my real name. So
okay.
I'm at Gloria Felt, but.
Great.
Yeah, maybe I'll resurrect Heartfelt sometime because I really liked her.
Yeah, I liked her too. And so don't forget when you go looking online that it is spelled with a D, F-E-L-D as in dearest, T.com.
Yes.
So,
thank
yeah.
you.
And if you do get the book, I see on your website that you will sign a nameplate for anybody who sends in an email.
I will do that. I discovered as I was doing book events that sometimes the booksellers didn't have enough books. And so my solution was that I got some book plates printed, and then I realized I should just let people know if you're out there, maybe you ordered it from Amazon or you ordered it from someplace else and or you're someplace where I don't get to see you and do a book event where I'm actually with you physically, that I would be delighted to sign a book plate to anyone who would like to have one. So just drop me an email, and I'm happy to do it.
On that note, we've got less than 20 seconds, so we're going to say thank you to Gloria for joining us. It was fabulous, and we'll see you all next week at our usual time on Mamacrat's Mama Chat.
Thanks so much, Gloria. You're wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
Bye.